Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
Open Loops, we have Jess Marion, someone who, one of the few guests that is an expert in the mind technology. We're talking hypnosis, NLP, that I've actually met in person, which I'm honored to have done. Yes, she has been doing this for a while now. HNLP and NLP trainer, hypnosis and hypnotherapy trainer, certified master coach, HNLP master practitioner, all the yoga nidra. She's an author, TEDx speaker, very much on the exploratory side of hypnosis, which I love so much, but melting it with practical results. She really has brought both of the worlds together, and works with Sean and Sarah Carson, part of the Intelligent Hypnotist. Recently came out with a great book, rave reviews, The Hypnotic Coach. But you can read all those books on Kindle. I mean, they so much good stuff. I mean, Jess is contributing a lot to the field, so I'm excited to have her on. Jess, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I am honored to take part in the podcast and the show, because I've been following you for a long time since you started to dive into this whole world of connecting this way. So this is going to be a lot of fun. And hello to all the viewers and listeners out there. I'm really looking forward to our discussion tonight.
Yes, yes. Well, look, and of course, I mean, you can appreciate this. And even, I think I did a workshop that you and Sarah put on in the city about scriptless hypnosis. I know it was an introductory class, but even that, I remember you opened the class by talking about this story of you sitting on a train and the raindrops coming down. and then you kind of left it there, and everybody in the room was already in an altered state, and then you like went into something else, and I'm going, wow, she was doing open loops. She was doing it. I mean, and that's one of the things, nested loops. It's one of the best, it's why I love going to hypnosis trainings. Now, I will say, I think it has a bit of a mystique around it, which I'm sure we can get into, when it comes to, you know, could you just be a trainer that talks in unfinished fragments and somehow unconsciously install an entire healing modality in someone? I'm not sure. But I am curious. I mean, let's start here, just so, since it's thematic of the show. What is your relationship with open loops and storytelling as a means of training people and even in coaching with people?
So storytelling, just generally speaking, is one of the primary ways in which we learn. It is actually built into our brain through evolution. Like back in the day, we didn't have in ancient times a formal education system. people learned important cultural values, behaviors, activities, expectations through story. So our brain is wired for this. So it makes it an incredibly powerful modality when done well. When a listener hears a story, as long as they associate it and they become emotionally invested in what's happening, or at the very least curious about what's going to happen, you have a lot of opportunity there to introduce ideas that they may have otherwise been consciously resistant to. You can pre-frame experiences that they're about to have. You can out-frame things that you don't want to come up within the session or within the training. So in general, storytelling is really powerful in the training environment specifically. We use it for pre-framing, reframing, out-framing. We also use it as a means of giving covert demos. So if we don't want to necessarily bring somebody up to the front of the room because maybe it's just not the time based on what's happening in the group dynamic, we can do the demo through storytelling. And what's really nice about that is it really invites everybody in the room to have that therapeutic experience.
Interesting.
So that would be like storytelling as a whole. Now, when we get to nested loops, open loops, closing loops, you know, nested loops, at least when I grew up in the hypnosis world, was kind of the gold standard. Oh, we have to be like Erickson or be like Bandler and tell these like 20 layer deep nested loops.
Yeah.
And I found that in client work, we don't have to do that. We don't have to work so hard. In trainings, though, nested loops let you do some really interesting things. They let you, if you open up certain loops and not close them, just like the train story, it creates a theme that will run through the training. It lets you also overtly set hypnotic themes at another level within the loop. You create amnesia, which is, you know, really good in certain scenarios in a group situation. Also, if you do anything hypnotic as a group experience, especially early on, you're going to start to facilitate unconscious rapport within the group itself. So you're helping the group move through the forming, storming, norming, performing, and transforming phases of group dynamics. So it's really useful there. It's fun to do if you do it well. If you do nested loops, it doesn't just have to be story either. So one of the things that in trainings I do now is at least one of the loops within a nested loop is going to be a Markov chain, which creates really deep trance very quickly because it leverages linguistic confusion and ambiguity. You can give lots of direct suggestions in a nested loop. When you begin to close the loops, the thing to keep in mind is what does the group need that you want them to carry out beyond the scope of the nested loop or beyond the scope of the training? There are certain loops that you don't want to close because you would like the participants to dream into a new way of being beyond the class.
Wow.
So in training, it's really important. In client work, we don't have to be that fancy. It's a lot easier. I mean, you can do it if you happen to be a natural storyteller.
Yeah.
I tend to have to plan my loops at least a little bit. Sometimes I can do it on the fly, but a lot of times I kind of have to think, okay, what's my theme? What are we doing here? Bandler's a natural storyteller. He opens loops and leaves them open sometimes, you know, forever. So if you want a wonderful example of a masterful nested loop storyteller, watch anything from Bandler.
I was going to say, I mean, look, he's really the guy we're talking about here. And truthfully, I mean, we can say his name because he is really the person that also popularized with John Grinder this notion of unconscious installation, which, again, and this is where it gets weird, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, because I even saw a post, this is tangentially related, but it's a parallel example, and I wonder sometimes about hypnotists getting a little too caught up in the mystique. I know I do sometimes, but someone posted in a public Facebook group, saw a hypnotist recently. I feel like I was getting gaslit by this person because I didn't get any results that I could feel. I don't even think I was in trance, but the person kept saying, well, that's part of the unconscious process. That's let it happen. So then I'm going, well, okay, I do think one of the beautiful things about hypnosis is this idea of utilization, and whatever the client brings you, you're able to use and twist to match where they're at so that you can give them a unique experience. But to me, I'm going, when does it go? When does it go too far? When are we just making things up that are happening in the client that, and then it just becomes almost as relevant as the placebo effect, which isn't to shoot down the placebo effect either, because I know you're big on that too. I love the placebo effect, but if I'm going, oh, if I can just pretend, if I can really invest in handing someone this pill, then why do I need to go and learn all these beautiful hypnotic language patterns if they don't? I guess I'm wondering, are you able to measure ever the impact of each pattern and intervention you're doing so you can see if it's working? Or is there a little bit of like, I know the recipe, and if they get the taste, well, hey, it might work, it might not, but it's really the results that count. A lot of questions in there, led a lot of different directions, but I'm curious your thoughts on that.
So this is a really, really good question, or set of questions. So I'll do my best to answer them from what I can remember. There is no objective measurement. How we determine what's happening with the client is two ways. First, we're calibrating to what is the body showing? What is their voice telling us? Not the words, but what's the voice telling us? What's the body showing? Because that's going to let us know what state they're in. Like if I were working with you and you were not in trance and you're saying, I'm not in trance, I'm not going to gaslight you because your body's saying, I'm not in trance. If I had another client who said that they weren't in trance, but their physiology definitely shows trance, I'm going to become really curious about what it is they're experiencing and what are they expecting to experience.
Right.
But then you can veer off and do some really cool stuff like a conscious unconscious dissociation, that type of fun thing that's fun for the hypnotist and incredibly powerful and useful for the client. So our measure is always, what are we seeing and hearing from the client at any given moment? And if any moment where like we say something or do something that we think like should be totally spot on and awesome, but their physiology is not showing us awesome, we have to adjust. We have to pivot.
Yeah.
So that's way number one. And way number two is just to ask them, what's happening now? What are you experiencing? So we're always testing throughout the process where the client is, or to our best ability and their best ability to express what they're experiencing. That's going to let us know as well if we've missed something along the way that we have to kind of circle back to, or is going to let us know if maybe there is some resource that we didn't know about that happens to spontaneously present itself that we can leverage. So I'm going to say it's like 85% technique and 15% faith in placebo.
Right.
And if you have faith that that breakdown of numbers is correct, I have a bridge to sell you.
right.
I can explain it is you do have to have faith in the technique. You have to have faith in yourself. And most importantly, you have to have faith in your client's ability to change and to grow.
Yeah. Right. Good? No, I was going to ask. I mean, you come from that, I know you studied a lot of Igor Ledakhovsky's stuff, and do you still find yourself practicing that H+ principle?
Well, the H+ principle, this is the coaching state. This actually comes from John Overdorf, but you'll find it in lots of different schools of thought and hypnosis. It's in the Ericksonians, it's the you have to go first.
Right.
So absolutely, because here's the thing is you could be like technically the most skilled, amazing hypnotist in the world. Like you have every step of every induction memorized. You have like, you could just be super awesome, technically speaking. So if you were to like, if somebody were to like look at a write-up of what you're doing, they go, okay, that's really awesome. If that hypnotist though doesn't have the right relationship with the client, forget it. It change happens because of the relationship you facilitate with your client. It is the trust that you both have, it's the transference and countertransference that happen. I know like traditional psychologists might shy away from that, but it's actually a really important tool in therapy and in coaching. So that starts with us as practitioners to begin to facilitate that. And that, you know, that makes up for like a lot of things, a lot of missteps within a coaching dynamic. And if you have the relationship, if you have hypnotic rapport, you don't even really have to do a whole lot to create a trance. It just happens. And if it's just something that spontaneously happens in the space between you and your client, change also happens in that space.
I was about to ask, this is something new I'm picking up on. After years of studying this, I'm getting this from a different angle, which I appreciate, which is that there is something to this notion of, and this is why I'm always like, go to hypnosis, forget these. I mean, you could do therapy, you could do a life coach, but once you start really getting into hypnosis, it is such a shortcut in some ways, because you're right about this whole counter transference thing. I want to work with people when I'm looking somebody in the eyes and going through a trance, or even putting on a track and listening to the person. I'm invested in that person's belief that the change is going to happen. That's something, I don't know. I mean, in your experience training people over the years, how much of it is getting people to just believe that they have the ability to facilitate? I think it often stops in hypnosis. This is what I mean. It often stops at trance. I've been to so many trainings that are just, be the hypnotist. You're the hypnotist. You can get people in the trance. But to be a true agent of change, to believe that you can get there, that is not something I've heard touted as much in trainings.
And this will actually let me kind of circle back to a question that you brought up a little bit ago that I didn't answer. And that's the idea of unconscious installation.
Yeah.
Because there are trainings out there, and I'm not going to, you know, point fingers or anything, that market and talk about, you'll come in, we're going to teach all these inductions, and you're going to come out knowing like all of these change work skills, because we're going to install them unconsciously.
Yes.
That can work. However, the problem is then there's no conscious competence. That means in order for the new hypnotist to access those specific change work skills, they have to be in deep trance, which is not a problem. We should be in deep trance with our client. We should be connecting in that way. However, the problem happens because then the conscious mind goes, I didn't learn how to do this.
Right.
So it's kind of cut off from the unconscious skills. And in a training dynamic, that can actually be really, I've actually witnessed this. It can completely derail a training because if students don't know that they've picked up unconscious skills, they have no way to willfully implement it. It's like having a hot mug of tea, but no handle. It has to have a
What does that look like? Do they just kind of walk around and they're all of a sudden talking and a person's going through an experience and they have no idea why? I mean, what is an unconsciously skilled change worker do that they're not able to make sense of consciously, as an example?
Well, it's within the context of seeing clients. I mean, I don't train this way. I know Steve Gilligan does in his trance camps, and I've known a ton of people who've gone through his in-person trance camp and would say, yeah, I don't really know what we did on those 3 weeks, but now when I sit down with a client, they just change and I don't know how.
What?
So that's what that looks like. So if you want the absolute like wonderful, beautiful example of unconscious competency, but maybe some conscious not understanding, people who train with Steve Gilligan extensively. And that's because that's how Steve Gilligan works. He's very intuitive, very in the body. If you look at any of his manuals, it's really tough to find like an actual like step-by-step breakdown of something.
Right.
It's not how he works.
Yeah. He was the guy that, he was like the deep trance identification subject for Erickson, right?
He
was like in it for a while, if I recall. Interesting. I mean, is there an advantage to does he
for
think?
For some people, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely, for some people. Some people who maybe, know, I don't know who actually would be like the ideal candidate for this style. I'm not personally.
Yeah.
But I'm sure there are. And those are probably people who continue to train with Steve.
Right.
I tend, when I am a student of a modality, I want the unconscious experience. I want to be able to fully embody it and to feel its effect. So I know that it will work with clients. But then I still want to have a conscious framework so that I can implement it. I can have conscious choice as to when I implement it and when I don't.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you something about yourself for a second. In terms of your into hypnosis, I mean, was there ever a period, Jess, where you were doing direct suggestion? I mean, is there like a stage hypnosis career in your life that I don't know about? How did you even come upon hypnosis in general? I'm not even sure I know the story.
So I was actually, I saw a documentary or like a TV show with, I'm totally blanking on his name. The I Can Make You Thin guy.
Paul McKenna.
There we go. Paul McKenna. And this was like when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And he helped somebody get over a fear of flying. And at the end of the show, they went skydiving or something like that. And I just remember sitting there going, is this real? This looks like magic.
Yeah.
Magic's pretty cool. So it always had been an interest of mine. Then when I went to university, our library had a massive collection of like everything from Erickson, everything from Bandler and Grinder. So I just dove in my free time. But then I didn't really pursue it. I studied a lot. I had lots and lots of recordings and videos and stuff. But it wasn't until I was working on my PhD that I decided to actually train in hypnosis just because I needed to do something different from what I was doing in academia. And then like 2 weeks after my training, I went and opened my practice. So that's how I got into it. But my background was always Ericksonian based. So I didn't start out doing a lot of direct suggestion. Even my first training was with Igor, and there's not a whole lot of direct suggestion in the CHP. Yeah. Where I started doing direct suggestion was I was a year and a half into my practice back when I was down in Philly, and I had some friends who were into doing street hypnosis in the city. And I thought, you know what, this terrifies me, so I should go do it. So for about a month, every Thursday night, because in Philly, it's always Thirsty Thursday, so there's always like these lines around the block outside the bars, me and my friends would just go and do street hypnosis with people. And it really built my confidence.
Yeah.
And then I went, I don't have to do this anymore. It's no longer scary. So it's kind of no longer interesting to me.
Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's cool to see people's reactions, but it's not my style. I'm not a big showman.
Yeah.
But I use a lot of direct suggestion in my sessions. In fact, almost every session will have a component of direct suggestion. Especially if they're coming to see me and they specifically say, hey, I want a hypnosis session versus I want a coaching session. I'll still do it in the coaching session because they're in trance anyway. However, if they come to me saying they specifically want hypnosis, there is already an unconscious expectation there that I'm going to tell them what to do. So at some point, I need to meet that expectation, because if I don't, I run the risk of them coming out of the trance, knowing that they experienced trance, but uncertain of whether or not it really worked because I didn't tell them what to do.
Yeah.
So I do, in that respect, I will use very clear direct suggestion. And I find that it works. You know, you have somebody in a deep enough trance, you know, if the relationship is correct, even if the person's in a light trance, honestly, as long as the relationship is correct, there's nothing wrong with direct suggestion.
Yeah. What do you think about this? I mean, I've heard the view before. I've asked this publicly, and a lot of people gave me kind of mixed responses. Do you think the person has to want the change in order for change to happen?
It depends on the person, honestly.
Interesting.
I think there are certain things that they absolutely have to want to change. Smoking is one of them, because they better have had their last cigarette before they come in and see me.
Yeah.
And to me, that's commitment enough. But the truth of the matter is that anybody who comes in for any piece of change work, they naturally have a parts conflict. If they didn't, they wouldn't be seeing us for a session. because they'd either not feel like the issue is a problem, or they were able to change it on their own, no problem. So to expect a client to be 100% committed, I think is really hard. It's hard for the client, and it puts an unrealistic expectation on both the client and the hypnotist, because at some point in the therapeutic relationship, you are going to come up against a no from the client. You're going to come up against whatever that part is that blocked them from creating the change. That doesn't mean that they're not invested in the change, but I think it's unrealistic to expect that they have to totally want it. They do need to have more energy in the direction of wanting it, though. If they don't, if they're split 50-50, we can work with that. We can do some exploration, maybe some values work to kind of get them across the threshold. Otherwise, you know, they have to, most of them has to want the change, because if they don't, to me, then it becomes a very murky ethics territory, because who am I to say what change is appropriate for this client? You know, I've come across it a few times. I saw a post in a group a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, and this hypnotist was working with a woman who wanted to quit smoking. Her husband smoked too, but didn't want to quit. So the hypnotist thought that they were super clever and gave the client a recording to listen to at night and said, oh, well, don't listen with headphones. To try and make the husband change.
Interesting.
Like, to me, that is a really not a good ethics situation, but that's my frame of the world.
Yeah.
So we have to be clear about that. And yes, as much as the hypnosis world would like to say that you can't hypnotize somebody to do something that they don't want to, we know that that's not true. You absolutely can, but you have to be really skilled to do it. And to me, that's too much work.
Too much work. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, do you believe that a really skilled hypnotist could conversationally make someone believe that they really want to change if they didn't before?
I think so. I think this once again comes down to how much work do you want to put in?
Yeah.
But there's not necessarily a problem with that. So like I said, if somebody's 50-50, or even if they're like 60-40, like 60% not wanting the change, I might still explore that with them, because they took the time to, you know, find me. They took the time to go through the interview process, you know. So I'll explore that. But then at the end of the day, I have to say, like, look, what is it you actually really want? Because it might not even be the change that they say that they want. They might come in with saying that they have this one thing that they want to change, because, you know, either they want to test you out to make sure like the relationship is right, that they feel comfortable with you before they share like their deeper stuff. Or it could be that they don't consciously know what's wrong. So right. They kind of have figured something that they could bring to the table. So you work through that. And as you kind of peel back the layers, then it's like, oh, actually what's really going on here is this other thing. So that can absolutely happen. Other than that, I'll do a lot of values work with somebody who is kind of 50-50 or unsure. We'll do some exploration.
Yeah. Yeah. Do people, I mean, look, you were out there doing this stuff. You were out there coaching and doing this stuff before everybody, at least everybody that I follow, but who knows, it could just be the Facebook algorithm, decided to become a coach and become a transformational coach. I mean, That's such a buzzword that gets thrown around these days. Here's what I'm wondering, though. Back in the day, and I'm talking, you know, I mean, I probably first met you around 2013, which not too long ago, but still long enough ago. When people were coming to you for coaching, what did people want? I mean, did they know about NLP? Were they looking for specific results? Did they want a coaching relationship? Because it doesn't feel as overtly in your face back then as it is now.
Yeah, it's become like a popular buzzword, which actually I'm kind of happy about, because coaching seems to be more accepted in the mainstream than hypnosis, as much as I'd like to see hypnosis be like having the coaching label does make some things a little bit easier. In terms of like back in the day, 2013, The clients who came to me, and it's probably the same now, the clients who came to me for hypnosis, it was very traditional stuff. Stop smoking, weight loss, sleep problems. I had a lot of people with like sleepwalking and night terror stuff, which is really interesting to work with.
Yeah.
Kind of the generic anxiety, that type of thing. The people who came to me for coaching wanted more long-term change. They'd be like, I have all these different areas, things aren't working in my life, so I want to make shifts, but I don't really know what's going on. I do some more spiritual based coaching as well. And so that actually started to take off in 2013. And I had a number of long-term clients for that type of work, because you can't package it into a single session. You know, hypnosis, for better or worse, has this reputation, both in the minds of many hypnotists, as well as prospective clients, that it is a magic bullet. It's like one session, maybe three sessions max, done. That is possible. There are lots of things that is totally, totally possible. Fear of flying, nail biting, smoking cessation, 100%, sleepwalking in some cases. It just depends on the client. However, I would invite people to think about, whether you call yourself a coach or you call yourself a hypnotist, that the work we're doing with clients isn't just about changing that one thing that they say. We are opening a door for them so that they can dream into a new way of being in life, whatever that means for them. So a coaching relationship tends to be a bit longer term because we get to explore that more. It's like, going to the gym once a month and expecting to get the same results as if you went to the gym every day. That's fine if you want to lose, 10 pounds for a wedding to do like the shortcut or to quit smoking. But if you want longer term transformation for yourself or for clients, you might want to consider offering longer coaching. And what do you do in those sessions? NLP, hypnosis, EFT, clean language, energy work, wherever your interests are. I've done tarot for people in coaching sessions. It just depends on what's happening in the dynamic.
Yes. And we're going to get into the tarot piece. Now, first of all, also, I definitely did not lose even close to 10 pounds for my sister's wedding. So now I feel like totally horrible about myself. But it would have been about the work. You're absolutely right. I agree that you've made me think about coaching in a different way. The exploration of identity. That is a fascinating notion to me, and it's what drew me to really go deep into hypnosis, because again, I do think you're right that it often stops. It often, in a way, isn't for business purposes. It can be really smart to zone in on one niche. Go in, be the weight loss person. That's how you start getting clients, all this stuff. But my brain, which has always been much more, I don't know if it's my Aquarius side, some people say it's just a creative, like fringe loving side, has gone, yeah, but they were, have you ever done deep trance identification? Have you ever made someone believe and step inside of someone else in a deep trance and see what happens then? Because that to me is the coolest part. Probably every podcast interview I've ever done, I bring up deep trance identification. I'm like, hey, who cares about this stuff? It's this stuff that's super cool. And I don't know. I guess it's a little harder to market. I certainly would love to, and might be down the line a little bit, do like some sort of developmental program with people where we're exploring stepping into other identities and reaping the rewards of that. I think that could be pretty cool. But, traditional society already doesn't accept hypnosis. So how are you gonna get them on board with that?
So your niche is not the technique. Your niche is the result.
Right. So my question is, what could you say the result even is? I mean, I've heard people say deep level identity change, but also that to me is kind of like, what? What does that mean?
It's big questions. So my typical, and I, because I have the book, I kind of have some good luck in not having to market this too hard. for deep trans identification, if somebody comes to me for deep trans identification, they tend to be a musician, an actor, an artist, or an athlete. Those are like my four main categories of clients who want to do deep trans identification. And then it's a long process. It's a 10 session process with homework. And so they're coming because they have, they either want to lay the foundation for building out a new skill, or they had a skill in the past that they want to revivify, or they have some component of their skill set, some small component that they want to refine. So this is all generative coaching. There aren't major problems that they can say is blocking the transformation. It's just they don't know how to get to where they want to be. So deep trans identification gives us a pathway to do that. Within a therapeutic dynamic, so generative being people who are doing and feeling something that they want to do and feel more of versus therapy where somebody's doing or feeling something that they don't want to anymore. On the therapeutic side, I'm not going to do a full, in most instances, I'm not going to do a full DTI program. If the client is right, I might, if they ask for it. I had one client who came to mind who asked for it, and she was a beautiful candidate for it, and it worked. But there are other instances based on the type of problem that a client brings in where I am definitely not going to use DTI. And the few times that I didn't trust my intuition on it, it was a no-go. It was just disastrous.
Oh my gosh. What happened? Can you talk about it?
So the one instance without giving away any details, this individual was not going to be, you know, they asked for DTI. I said no, worked with them and over time, and they seemed to be at a place where it was okay. And it just kind of destroyed the coaching relationship. So I learned my lesson. Yeah,
that's interesting. But what about, okay, so in these 10 sessions, I mean, again, I think it's remarkable when I did this to someone, and I actually did this to an actress who was asking to just, she was like, I love being hypnotized, and I was testing things out, and this was back in, her roommate was there too. She wanted help with running, so I ran a traditional direct suggestion session first, and then she was like, also, I just want to experience hypnosis, so I don't even care. Make me forget things. Make me stick to things. Whatever. So then I ran this deep trans identification with a shared acting teacher that we both had. I had her step inside this person, as if she was experiencing all the memories that of this person's life. I've never seen an acting performance like that in my life. I mean, she truly did not seem like she was acting. The physicality shifted. The voice was entirely different. It was, I mean, if actors aren't investigating, trying this out, they really should be, because it is remarkable. So to me, that was mind blowing. I mean, have you ever seen celebrities or famous people channeled in your room, and you're going, wow, I didn't know this is Steve Jobs is here all of a sudden? I'm very curious.
So the one thing, actors are wonderful to work with DTI, because if they've had any training in method acting, even just a little bit, it's a very similar process. So those neural pathways are already there, which is awesome. In terms of, have I channeled anybody? You know, it's hard to say yes and no. Like, I've definitely, I've had experiences with clients where they've accessed things that they didn't know about the person. Wow. I know John Overdorf talks about this as well. I did, for myself, I did a DTI project. This was, probably back in 2013, 2014, with Rasputin. And I got about 3 weeks in and said, I can't do this. Can't do it. Because the energy was just, nope. So that channeling, I don't know, but it definitely was no longer congruent. And it was like very evident that this was like, do not pass go, do not collect $200. Stop now.
Rasputin, oh my gosh. Talk about a good hypnotist, right? I mean, this is, holy crap. Is there anything that you think you took from Rasputin? Is there anything hypnotists or people in general can take from Rasputin as a change worker that would make them better hypnotists?
Yes. So he had around him, just like Steve Jobs did, this distortion field, this reality distortion field, where people will just believe. And that's really incredible. I would say if you want that, do not use Rasputin, but Steve Jobs is a wonderful model for it.
Yes. And there's a book. Did Sean write that book or do you write that book?
Sean wrote that book, yeah.
Got it. Yeah, it's one of the books by Sean Carson in this collection of techniques that Jess and Sean have written about over the years. Yeah, also the Deep Trance Identification book they co-wrote, and then the manual, which goes along with that, is really it's great that you brought that technique to the masses. I mean, I love that it's out there. And I remember when I first came into the Hypnosis Center in New York City, I think I was talking to Sean, and I said, "Hey, do you guys ever play with Deep Trance Identification?" And he's like, "Yeah, actually, we just did it last week. Yeah, as part of this NLP training." I'm like, "What? You guys just do this for fun? Like, what is?" Which is great because you've gone so much further than that. I mean, when you come up with new techniques, you start exploring Markov chains, or you're discovering new coaching patterns, stuff like that. Talk to me just a little bit about that process. I mean, are you just kind of sitting around and brainstorming with Sean? Are you trying things out and codifying? I mean, what is the Intelligent Hypnotist brand? How do you all develop these new experimental ways of working with clients?
So it's really hard to consciously like sit down and go, "Okay, I'm going to create something."
Yeah.
Well, how we do it is a lot of experimentation. And what for me tends to happen is I'll come across something. I'll see like a demo, or what started us down the road of DTI was I was in a training with John in the same space you were in. And he talked about it just briefly. And I texted Sean, I'm like, "Hey, do you want to play with DTI?" And he's like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Okay, let's do it." And that led to a year of experimentation between each other and with our clients. Yeah. These days, it's similar. Like if something really gets my attention and my interest, then I become very curious as to how I can integrate it into client sessions, and then how can I teach it? So first I'm going to experiment with clients, and then I'm going to bring it to the community, experiment in the class setting, and then notice the feedback that I'm getting from the participants, and then I'll tweak it and refine it. Then if everything seems to be cool, then maybe turn it into a product or a book. If I try something with a bunch of clients and it's just not going anywhere, of course I'll do something different in the session with the client, but then that says to me, okay, I'm either not thinking about this correctly, or maybe this isn't as cool as I thought it was. So maybe I need to kind of step back for a little while.
Right. No, I mean, I know you, and you recently did this mind lab with Sean, which was really, I mean, I didn't have the ability to attend any of those sessions, though. I might have to in retrospect, because yeah, you had stuff like Radiant Coaching, the Michael Jordan pattern. I mean, when you notice a pattern that can be helpful for reframing, does that just come from, you know, watching The Last Dance during the pandemic and going, "Wait a minute, I think there's something here"?
Yeah. I mean, you get, I would highly encourage anybody in our field who wants inspiration that they can use in our field to look outside.
Yes.
That's how you get creative. If you start making connections between disciplines that didn't seem like there was any connection before, then you start to think in new ways. You start to think in terms of innovation. It makes you more curious. And then you have more material to experiment with. You know, there's nothing wrong with something like the Almond Induction. But honestly, if I had to do that with every session and every client, I think I would go out of my mind. The same is true with direct suggestion, if the whole session was just direct suggestion, or re-imprinting with every client, or parts work with every client. To me, that's not interesting. And if it's not interesting, if I don't feel it, I'm not going to be a very good coach for other people.
Yeah.
Because it is a relationship.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, that's one of the things that certainly Even as I was reading, I think it was the Quit Smoking book you both wrote. You give a lot of different ways. I mean, in general, this is one of the trademarks of Sean and Jess. You give a lot of different ways of going about interventions. And as someone like me, that sometimes is very, okay, what's the next step? And what's the next step? I'm going, oh crap. What do I do for this person? Do I go this way? Do I go this way? Am I going to give him the Scrooge pattern? Am I going to give him this pattern? And then you add more and more, and it makes me wonder, again, I guess you're trying to give your clients the ability to be as flexible as possible. So, why wouldn't you be as flexible? But for someone that's starting out, I mean, do you recommend sticking with a couple things first and then expanding the library, or do you think it could be valuable to just get all this stuff somewhere in the unconscious so they're ready to pull it out? What do you think?
It depends on the hypnotist. So for some people, and actually this is how I learned, this is how I integrated. Every time I learned a new pattern, actually I still do this if I learn something new. I will say like, okay, on Wednesday, all of my clients, I'm going to practice this pattern. I'm going to find a way to make it work in the session. And then I let go. I don't like try to find the point in the session where I'm going to do it consciously. It just happens because I've set the intention. I've pre-framed my unconscious mind that at some point in the session we'll do whatever the pattern is. And I did this over time for like all the NLP patterns. Like I said, I still do it if I learn something new. It's a way to ingrain it because ultimately patterns do not get the change. This is really important. Like I want everybody to understand this. And I know like the procedural people who like steps are going, oh,
Right,
what do I
right,
do?
right.
What patterns do, what techniques do is they create the ritual that facilitates a relationship that causes change for the client and for the hypnotist. The pattern is kind of the scaffolding with another metaphor here, that supports the relationship, but it's the relationship that gets the change. If you had like every step of every pattern in the Quit program like memorized and down pat, you better be totally invested in the client's change. Otherwise, the patterns are going to be hit or miss.
Yeah. That's
So I would
interesting.
say if you're procedural, meaning you like to have steps, that's great. So start with the number of techniques or steps that are comfortable for you that you know starting out, you're confident that it will help a client experience a shift within the session. And then gradually add on to that. And what you'll find happening is you're going to get to the point very quickly where you'll start to unconsciously understand the mechanisms or the patterns that underlie the patterns, the principles that make the pattern.
Yeah.
And then that gives you a lot of flexibility to be playful and to trust your unconscious that you don't have to plan out the steps. You can be totally present with your client, and whatever they give you is okay, as long as you're calibrating and you know how to move them from a negative state into a positive state.
Yeah. Do you think you can track every change worker at this point? I mean, if you have you ever seen anybody in recent years, Jess, where you watch them go through a session and you're going, okay, I truly have no idea how that change happened.
Yes, and in those instances, I fall back on it's the relationship. It's totally the relationship. There are if I were to like sit down and technically break it down, I probably could, like in terms of the meta pattern. In fact, I'm confident that I can. But does that necessarily mean that it was my explanation that caused the change? Maybe yes, maybe no. We did a series of blog posts. This was like 5 or 6 years ago, where we went through a bunch of videos that were on YouTube and did that and did a breakdown of what people were doing. So like Erickson, Satir, Fritz Perls, kind of the classics. And there is that flaw of looking at it through my 21st century lens versus, 1970s. So it's already a bit of a mind read, but it's a useful exercise. And I would encourage people to do that. Like watch videos of your favorite hypnotist. Can you break down what they're doing?
This sounds like we're going to do critical hypnosis theory. This is like a whole new, yes, there's going to be a movement of it, I swear. But yeah, no, that is interesting. You're right. Time does play a difference in that. It makes you wonder about the whole Erikson mystique in general. So many people that weren't Erikson breaking down his stuff to the point where, I know he definitely, there was a quote about him taking a pot shot at Pandler and Grinder. Something about what they got the shell, but not the, I remember that he definitely was like, what are these boys doing? So yeah, it's but that I guess is just the nature of reality too, right? We can't ever fully I don't know. I mean, is that, well, this is an interesting question. So when it comes to the NLP practice of modeling and modeling subjective experience, which was such a promise, Jess. I mean, it was the coolest thing in the world. I think I was reading the Joseph O'Connor book. It was the NLP comprehensive book about introducing NLP. And I remember them saying that this is the study of subjectivity. And I'm going, whoa, this is so cool. You can track how someone's eyes move in a certain direction and then what picture they have of their mind before they maybe tell a great joke on stage or stuff like that. It made me believe that you could really do anything. But I feel like modeling is so... it's never really done at that level. And that's even a criticism I had with... I think I brought it up to Sean in 2013. I said, why aren't there more models? There's some great ones. And he gave me the phobia cure story. But there are a lot of great models that have come out. But it had such a promise to get inside the unknowable from the outside. And yet, there's not a lot of move your eyes in this direction if you want to hit a softball like Derek Jeter might. I'm curious what you think about the answer to, has NLP lost its modeling core? And if not, where can we find it?
Right. So controversial comment. Yes, it has. And here's why. NLP was always open source, and it was always an open system, at least when it started. And what happened over time, as Bandler became a bit more litigious and Bandler and Grinder split up, and then you had the first generation and second generation NLPers, it became codified into this system. And it's become a closed system. So if you try to introduce new patterns, unless you're a first gen or maybe a second gen NLPer, it's like, oh, that's not NLP, that's something different. So I kind of take issue with that because I think NLP should evolve, but that's just, I'll get off my soapbox about that.
No, this is good. We want the controversy. Keep going.
And if you look at a lot of the marketing around NLP, it's mostly geared in the US towards therapists, in the UK geared towards therapists and businesses.
Yes.
That will directly use the label NLP. NLP is marketed to individuals doing transformational trainings and courses, but it's not called NLP in that instance. It's given all sorts of other fancy branding. So it's become just this system of techniques and language patterns.
Yeah.
And in that, it's also lost a little bit of the magic in some circles. And a part of this has to do with the founding of NLP, because it was based on the metaphor of a brain being a programmable computer. It is not. That is not anywhere close to how our neurology works. So that's kind of problematic. And that was the main metaphor in the 70s. So we can understand where this came from. But that metaphor is, I still hear it put out there in the training world over and over and over again. And that takes away the modeling of subjective experience, because it's subjective experience. It's not modeling. It's not modeling one person and generalizing it out to an entire population. You can't do that. So if you take eye accessing, for example, eye accessing is a model, but just because someone looks up into their left, it doesn't mean that they're accessing memories. Just because they look up into the right doesn't mean that they're accessing, creating images. I keep my memories all over the place. Most people keep them visually. So we have to calibrate to the individual clients. So we're tracking through the session. If we're asking them questions about things that happened in the past, where do they naturally go? If we ask them about their outcome, where do they go when they can access the outcome? Where do they go when they can't access the outcome? It's usually to the past. So we want to model that. We want to model the subjective experience of the client sitting in front of us. We can't model something like where to put my eyes to bat, like Derek Jeter, because I am, if you don't know this about me, I'm really terrible at baseball. So that's not ever going to happen. It's a certain level of subjective experience that goes into skills building. So we have to allow for that. And everybody is different. So when we model subjective experience, for me, I'm modeling the subjective experience of the client in front of me. And that's it. I'm entering into their map of the world to the best of my ability and bringing some of my map in to help them expand their map beyond what the problem allowed them to experience in the past. And if we treat problems as something that we can model, then it becomes really easy to undo the problem. That, for me, that's where modeling of subjective experience comes in. And I think that it's been lost, not in all NLP circles, not by a long shot, but you know, the glitzy marketing circles, it seems to have been lost. Because now it's all about, you know, McDonald's therapy. As fast as you can go, run them through like 10 patterns in an hour, send them on their way.
Right.
Which is just how I work.
Right. I'm totally with you. I'm all about bringing it back. It would be so cool. And also, I would just love to see developments in the field of modeling excellence. It was talked about so much at the beginning of NLP, this idea of the difference that makes the difference. But, you know, it's very much veered off from that. And it stayed in the world of modeling excellent therapists. Now, some people, I mean, you got Kinder Cleveland, Michael Breen, they went off and developed these business programs using NLP as the base. And it's very good work. But... I've often just wondered, where is it gone? How do we bring it back? Is there anybody interested in doing it? It's a, you know who does it? Jonathan Altfeld is genius mapping. He's one of the guys out there that is saying, hey, yeah, you can still use different ways of deconstructing a mind. Let me ask you something. Because I wanted to create, so I had this idea that I was going to work with people and come up with this. I wanted to run unconscious audits with people. So I had this notion that I'd have people sign up. I'd sit with them for a half hour. They would talk to me about their life. And by the end, I could go, okay, here are the three or four biggest blocks in your unconscious that a hypnosis session could help you with. And then as I was sitting down and thinking about my trainings and starting to read stuff and go through books, I went, is that even possible? Is there a procedure that could possibly allow me to discover simply by having a conversation with someone where they're blocked in their unconscious from a high level? Off the top of your head, is there something out there? Am I missing something?
Listen literally.
Oh.
That is going to be your number one skill. Clients will reveal where the blocks are through how they describe the problem or how they describe their life. Now, if it's just kind of this general description of life, you can do it, but it might be a very big chunk to try and do this.
Yeah.
So you might want to have it more contextualized. So one area of their life might be a more manageable chunk, but you'll hear them come back over and over again to certain themes. So you'll hear it in their choice of language. They'll reveal things like in terms of scaffolding. So are there very old parts of their brain that are active when they're experiencing the block? That'll let you know the kind of block. So for example, like somebody who says something like, you know, I struggle with this coworker. Their personality is just larger than life. And I just, I feel like my work is just dwarfed by them.
Right.
Well, they're telling you right there that you probably need to do a regression at some point. That's a scaffolding thing. They're looking up to mom and dad.
Interesting.
So we don't necessarily tell them that, but that's just something to file back in the back of the mind. They'll tell you through how they experience the blocks in their body. So we really want to listen carefully to how they're describing where they're at. And that doesn't mean that you're going to get like all of the blocks. That's really difficult to do because they might not even be, have full access to it. But you will get a sense of how they're doing the blocks. And that's where you want to help them begin to undo it. We want to be careful as well because we don't want to implant problems that are not there.
Right. Exactly.
So it is a balance.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. I mean, it's kind of assuming that there might be a block by running something like that. Though I kind of love that. I mean, it came from psychics is really what it comes down to. Psychics do this all the time. You go to a psychic and they're trying to sell you on the next thing. So they'll say, I mean, I had someone do it in the city. You probably even know where it is. It's over on, it was by 14th Street and 6th Ave, kind of like a little bit. You walk off the curve. There's a woman there that was a psychic. She sat down with me. She said, Greg, you know, I sense leadership potential in you. I said all this stuff that she could have even just picked up on consciously. But then she's like, but there's a love block. There's something blocking you. And if I'm going to clear this, well, it's going to be $295. I'm going like, what? What love block are you picking up on? So then my immediate thought was, well, I'm wondering if, and this is where we're going to start bending reality a little bit here, Jess. By being a hypnotist, by grounding it a little more in something that, to me, at least the mind is tangible, and change in the mind is more of a tangible thing. When people ask me if I've ever had a paranormal experience, I haven't personally, but I always talk about weird things that have happened with hypnosis, and that being, it really is a bridge for me. So my thought is that, well, maybe a skilled mind expert could look at someone and identify unconscious patterns in a way that sees room for wizardry and change work potential. I mean, I don't know. At this point, I imagine that you definitely recognize things that you're not even consciously sure how you recognize them. But yeah, I mean, what would you be like as a psychic right now? You think you could, I bet you'd be pretty good.
So the thing with that is the mind is a meaning making machine.
Yeah.
So that's like, it gave you a really nice pace, but that's a generalization. I mean, if I were to go up to anybody on the street and say, look, can I just have a word with you for a minute? Cause I'm picking up something.
Right.
You know, you really strike me as somebody who has really strong leadership qualities, but I feel like there's something holding you back. People want to be leaders. So that's going to appeal to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Then to make the jump to the love block, that's a lead. She's going to make you go inside and try and find that connection when that connection may not have been there before.
Right.
So that's where we get into this kind of gray area of, you don't want to implant problems that don't exist.
Yeah.
So the client will tell you how they're doing the problem. That's all you need to know. That's all you need to model. They'll tell you, they will unconsciously tell you and show you everything you need to know about the problem, including where it is in the body, how fast or slow it's moving. They will give you everything you need and not always be consciously aware they're doing it.
Right.
Now, if I have a client, and I don't offer this to clients, but a couple of clients know that I read cards. So if they ask me, I'll do a reading for them. That's a very different type of coaching, because what's happening there, first of all, it's nice and dissociated. So the problem, the question is out on the table in front of us. But no matter how I read the cards, because of the nature of the relationship and because of what I know about the querent and what I know about the nature of the question they're asking, they're going to unconsciously start to make connections. That's the beauty of tarot cards. It invites us to make connections that we hadn't considered before. It forces us to look at a question or a problem from a very different perspective. It takes us out of our habitual patterns. So that's where you can talk about things like, well, you know, the cards are saying here that there is Six of Cups, there's an imbalance or an insecurity in the love life or something like that. But in standard coaching, I tend to not do that as much because we don't have to. And the more clients you see, the more refined your ear becomes to pick up on the things that they're saying, but they don't know they're saying.
Yeah. Now, look, I'm gonna go right for it. I need to know, how did you get here? Because the Jess Marion that I knew and Sean Carson, for a while, you were both holding up, you know, John Overdurf was running these neuroscience and hypnosis trainings. He became this certified neuroscientific hypnotic NLP practitioner. So I'm going, okay, this is great. This is what we need in the community, because at the very least, we have people out there that are doing this regularly and talking about the neurology, the things that the way it, why change works and how it can be supported by what's going on inside. And then all of a sudden you're doing hypnotarot, there's Tree of Life coaching, even in the Mind Lab there's this pranic coaching, energetic realities. I mean, half of these things are about this interconnected universe. Now look, I remember, and I know John Overdurf definitely, again, I think it's somewhere in the line, all you are is change, that these broad notions of what is identity and what is self. The thing that always grounded that for me as someone that came from a more skeptical mindset is that, well, yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense with hypnosis. It makes sense with the way life works and the way we evolve. But then to have a mystical component to things, well, that kind of it makes me wonder if you're going to start doing these quantum healing Dolores Cannon sessions at some point, which nothing wrong with it, nothing wrong with past life, maybe there is, I'm not sure, jury's still out for me on some of that stuff. But I am curious, when did the mystical kind of spiritual side of things start to enter your studies of hypnosis?
So it's always been there. I've been into mystical practice as long as I've been interested in hypnosis. So, you know, before I was a teenager, I was meditating. So it's always been there. And it wasn't really until fairly recently that we had at least some neuroscience models that create a space where we can talk about this if we want to talk about it in a materialistic way. But I've also experienced a hell of a lot of stuff that kind of defies logic in just in terms of life and my coaching clients. There's a lot more out there beyond what our brain tells us. If you think about even our physical form, we think like this is our shape, you know, that there is a Greg shaped body in the universe, except for as I'm looking at you, my brain is actually having to compress down you into a shape that's recognizable as human. So it's, you know, it starts to get really trippy. And we can talk about things like we know that the body gives off an electromagnetic field.
Yeah.
So it's not a far leap, but where it becomes useful, and at least where I sit, because I definitely sit both on the science side and the mystical side, and I can go, okay, there are things that science can explain and there are things that science absolutely cannot. And then there are things that science can explain, but are also mystical. So they kind of come together. But I like being able to explore a wider territory of thought, because things like tarot, Tree of Life, pranic work, these things have been around for millennia. They've worked for 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 years of human beings, if not more. So why not? There's wisdom there. So we can look at something like the tarot and I can say, well, you know, our reality, what we sense as ourself and the stories we tell ourselves are contained in what is known as the default mode default mode network in the brain. This is kind of the CEO of us. It is where our filters are. It is what hypnotists might refer to as the critical faculty. Mm-hmm. And we know now, thanks to studies over the last few years, that hypnosis, among other things, downregulates the default mode network. When the default mode network is downregulated, it causes something called neural entropy. Oh. Neural entropy is when different parts of the brain are firing off in novel ways, parts of the brain that haven't been able to communicate because of the stronghold that the default mode network has on our daily life. They haven't been able to communicate, and now they can. So now it's like there are all sorts of new neural connections being made. This is why hypnosis works. With something like tarot, I can easily say, well, it is a hypnotic induction without a doubt. If you go to a good tarot reader, you're definitely in trance. So the default mode network has been downregulated to some extent. Now we're looking at these pictures and the reader is crafting a story that is inviting novel parts of our brain to make new connections, which is automatically going to change how the default mode network interacts with the world when it comes back fully online. So we can explain it somewhat in terms of neuroscience if somebody likes that metaphor, but ultimately, neuroscience is a metaphor.
Crap.
It's a metaphor.
She did it to me. Interesting. That's a good point. Yeah. What do you mean by that for people that, make it a little more granular for me. I want you to break neuroscience down in that way.
Sure. Can we take one time out really quick?
Yeah. Sure thing.
Pause the video.
Okay. So break that down a little bit because I think I know what you mean, but I really want to know what you mean. Why is neuroscience a metaphor?
Because it's always evolving. It's not written in stone. And neuroscientists will tell you that they don't have 100% of the answers. They have models and they're very useful. And I like the model of the default mode network. I think it explains a lot in terms of the work that we do, but it's not the full story. There are different schools of thought all trying to answer in the neuroscience world the problem of consciousness.
Yep. Yeah.
And for those who sit in the sphere that consciousness is derived from the brain, then you could say, no, neuroscience is hard facts, even though it's evolving. If you happen to sit on the other side, which I do, that says the brain is a receiver, consciousness doesn't originate in the brain.
Totally.
Then things are more flexible. So I like the neuroscience metaphor. I find it works with a lot of clients. My default mode network really likes it. But when my default mode network is downregulated, I have no interest in it and I find it laughable. So.
Yeah. Well, I was going to also ask, I've just always thought, once somebody's hypnotized, whatever that means, and I know there's also debate about whether it's a place you're in, a trance is a place you're in or not, and it's state versus non-state, all that stuff. But when somebody, I'll take a best example I can come up with is stage hypnosis. When someone's on stage and they're quote unquote hypnotized, you can figure out, a hypnotist will ask a question, now why did you run up and run to the bathroom after I, for no reason? Why'd you come back after you touched that doorknob? And the person will come up with the most clever answer. People will say clever, funny, witty, smart, totally justifiable things. And I've always just gone, oh, I don't know. I guess it's just because now they're in trance, they're in creativity. But you kind of just broke down to me why it makes a lot more sense why that would happen.
Yeah. And stage hypnosis is an interesting one because I've seen enough stage shows where people were not hypnotized.
Right.
But there's a lot of social pressure and also fun. People who volunteer for a stage show, they want to have fun. So to me, it doesn't actually matter because it's entertaining.
True.
And then I think we get down to this. I happen to sit in the framework that hypnosis is a state. However, that doesn't mean hypnosis is one state.
Oh, interesting.
I would say it's a series of different states. And I think it's very tough when we talk about hypnosis in general, because the scientific community has a very antiquated definition or approach to hypnosis, but they have to, because it has to be a replicable, codified approach to hypnosis if you're studying it in the lab.
Yeah.
That's like, that's where we get like stupid statistics. Like, I don't know, 80% of people are mediocre hypnotic subjects versus the 20% who are deep trance. In reality, I've not found that to be true at all. But that's just because of the constraints, and that influences how lay hypnotists think about and talk about hypnosis. Hmm. So we could look at a non-state theory of hypnosis, social compliance. That doesn't mean it's not a state.
That's interesting.
You have somebody in a hypnotic interaction who knows that, like, culturally, and people's responses to hypnosis are very much so culturally dependent. So this would be like a check mark in the non-state people's book. Is they have these expectations, they are going to fulfill them. But they can't fulfill them through the default mode network. It just doesn't work. I mean, the most extreme example of this is I had a Balinese client, this was years ago, and I knew the Balinese trance dances and what trance traditionally looks like in Bali, but, you know, we're in the US. And this client went into deep trance, her eyes are open, the eyes are totally rolled back in her head, and her whole body shaking. I thought she was having a seizure.
Oh.
The default mode network cannot do that. I brought her out of trance. She was fine. She went back in trance, did the same thing again. I'm like, okay, this is the Balinese model of trance.
Yeah.
The default mode network can't create that. There were too many physiological things happening at once. It would fall outside the, you know, 5 to 9 bits of information type model that we all talk about.
Yeah.
So whether state or non-state, to me, it's all state. There are definitely signs of hypnosis versus regular default mode activity. So we can look for the variations in physiology that will let us know that the client's experience, something has changed inside of them. They're no longer in the same mode of being that they were when they first came in.
Hmm. Do you ever work in uptime with people? Yeah. Do you ever? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I do a lot of phone coaching, and you can do deep trance with it, but it's a little bit more awkward because they're in deep trance. So I'm not getting back the quality information that I need to know where they are in the process. So a lot of that is uptime trance coaching. In most instances, even on the phone coaching, at some point I'm going to do more of a downtime trance, because I want them, A, I want to meet their model of the world. And B, I want them to have an experience that they know is different from the problem and different from what they knew to be real when they came into the session.
Yeah. Well, this is always, and again, this is something you told me. You said one time, I remember you said to me, Greg, you're an actor. Ever try watching a great Shakespearean, if there's a part you're playing, watch Ian McKellen playing that part and go into trance and see what happens when you come out of it. And in a way, that was the biggest open loop ever, because you kind of sent me on a deep rabbit hole dive into self-hypnosis, and is there, what trance is she describing exactly? And am I supposed to like hypnotize myself and then open my eyes and watch it and then go back? And really, you could have just been saying, you know, like you said before, frame it for your I'm going to go in and watch this and get something that's going to be helpful for the role, and then sit there and watch it in with peripheral vision and just see what happens. I mean, that is a trance, but but it's still, the trances come in so many different forms. And as Richard Bandler pointed out, altered state from what? So, you know, in terms of when you say trance state, I know some people are very loose with this. Some people say love is a trance state. You're saying social compliance is a trance state. What do you mean by that? And do you differentiate the word trance from hypnosis?
I tend to not differentiate. I get like you could make the differentiation, like hypnosis is a process or a relationship that brings about a specific trance state if you want, but I kind of use them interchangeably. We all live in lots of different trances, but the question becomes for me, is the trance flexible?
Hmm.
If we're not flexible, that's the default mode network. That's our default trance that we go through life in. You're in love with somebody, your default mode network is not very active.
Hmm.
That's a hypnotic state. That's you're working more, you're existing more based on emotion and what's happening in the body. Sometimes to benefit, sometimes maybe not so much.
Right.
So we have a default trance, if you will. We have the story that our default mode network tells us about ourselves and about life. That's one type of trance. But then there are other trances where that is quiet and we have flexibility again.
Hmm. Yeah.
But it all becomes very, this kind of discussion, it becomes kind of murky because you can kind of go, okay, well, then if everything's trance, there's no such thing as trance, it's social compliance. Like you could make that loop back around.
Right.
Which I'm sure would make some people thrilled. But I
right.
say, don't hold on to labels and meanings so much. The question is the client or ourselves, are we in a mode of receptivity and flexibility? Or are we in a mode of focus and being a bit more locked in? And both have their benefit. Like, I don't want to like be ragging on the default mode network. It's what lets us live life. It's what lets us get things done. So it's fine. It has its purpose, but when it does hold components of an identity that we find problematic in place, then we need to reintroduce flexibility and receptivity.
Yeah. Now, I want to go back to something you said back in the mystical realm of things about consciousness being being the receiver. I'm curious about what experiences you've had. Maybe it's yourself, maybe it's working with a client, where it's clearly that is explainable beyond science. Can you speak about any of those?
So one example, I had somebody when I was in high school that I knew had severe epilepsy and they had a hemispherectomy. So literally half her brain was removed. She was still her.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's one example. I've had experiences with a very diminished default mode network that let me know that consciousness is not necessarily the functioning of the default mode network and not necessarily even the functioning of the brain. Not to go into too much information on a recorded call about that.
Yeah. Well, and then what is, I mean, I've asked this before to people. I had someone on my show that she goes, oh, you got to connect this woman, really, really, really nice lady, Katja Muchovic. I always get her last name wrong. She's a NLP and hypnotist and transformational coach in Italy. And she does this whole Golden Bridge program, she calls it, where she bridges your unconscious with your conscious with your superconscious. And that's her whole thing. And I said, what is the difference? Because I always thought the unconscious was, at least in my metaphor, and I always thought, well, isn't the unconscious really the realm of where you can get to the superconscious? Could you make the argument? Here's something for you. Someone once said to me, I said, hey, this Ouija board crap. It's crap because it's your ideomotor movements. Your unconscious mind is moving it. And then the person said, yeah, but what's moving your unconscious? And I went, oh, that's good. Crap.
This is why I don't touch things.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Again, it could just be semantics. It could just be words. But there's a part of me that wants to believe that a really skilled hypnotist could create a psychedelic experience just using the unconscious mind even before they've ever tried psychedelics. I don't know how much experimentation and that would take, but I don't know. I suppose I just have so much faith in this realm of unknowing that I believe it's somehow connected to a world beyond. But I know a lot of people don't think that way. What are your thoughts on this realm of the unconscious that I am so in love with and obsessed with?
You know, whether or not you can create a psychedelic experience through hypnosis alone, I am not convinced of it. I know a lot of hypnotists say that you can. I think maybe if you had a really good hypnotic subject, you probably could, because psychedelics do the same thing as hypnosis in that they downregulate the default mode network.
Yeah.
So they do that, but they also bind to serotonin receptors. So they change somewhat of how the brain chemistry is functioning. And they also drop brain waves down into slow delta while still being conscious. And I don't know if you can do all of that with hypnosis, but that doesn't mean I don't think it's possible either. I just think it would take a lot of experimentation. I mean, if you wanted to go that route and not use sacred substances, then I would say holotropic breathing would probably be the pathway to do it.
Oh, yeah. But
you can certainly do with clients, as long as they don't have hypertension issues. So that would be one modality. It's funny because I had this conversation with a lovely friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, not too long ago about how far can you take hypnosis?
Yes, this is what I want to know. This is what I really brought you on for, because I feel that you are on the edges of that in your work.
I don't know. I don't know if we know how far. I think it's going to depend on the creativity and the innovative nature of the facilitator and the flexibility and receptivity of the client or the individual who wants to explore. It just depends. It's so hard to say. Be curious, experiment out. Like I said, I'm not convinced that hypnosis can simulate everything that you can do with other modalities. But that doesn't mean it's not possible with the right practitioner.
Yeah. I mean, I had a guy on recently, David Ian Brager, who created Scriptnosis, which is like consent.
Oh, yeah.
You know that guy at all?
Yeah.
Yeah. He claims he was doing the metaverse in the 80s, early 80s, with people, with taking video game people and hypnotizing them and making them believe they were in this world. I'm going, yeah, what does hypnosis in the metaverse look like? I mean, I don't even know. We're talking about getting more in touch with spirit, and it feels like that is upending everything. But I don't know. I mean, if Jess Marion is called to start working with virtual reality and hypnosis, do you have any ideas of what you do?
I probably wouldn't.
Nice. That's a good response.
My interest is more in the land of psychedelics personally. So I'd probably go that route versus virtual reality.
Yeah.
That's another modality for exploring consciousness, if you will.
Totally, totally, totally. Okay, so look, you've been very generous with your time. I appreciate this. This is a very fascinating conversation. Tell me this. I'm curious your thoughts on, I want you to make me feel good about NLP and hypnosis, and here's why. And I asked this question to James Tripp, too, but I'm curious your take on it, because I had an existential crisis a couple years, well, yeah, no, one of many, but at one point, I started getting into the three principles and Jamie Smart's work. And what was interesting about it was that here's a guy that created an entire business based off NLP, was teaching it, raving about it, and then all of a sudden was saying, hey, if you, so many modalities are about changing thoughts, but what if it's just you recognize that the thought is there in the first place? And once you recognize everything is a thought, then you don't even need to do that work of repainting the house or building a new, building it, going back to the root and changing it. You don't even need to do it, because then you just realize it. And all of a sudden I was like, oh crap, does this guy just make now NLP and hypnosis irrelevant? does this, like, the idea of changing thoughts, and I mean, I love it. Also had Rex Sykes on the show recently, and he's talking about, you know, the attitude that you go through life and changing the image. I mean, he really speaks positively of the original NLP potential of imagine just going through the world and thinking beautiful thoughts instead of negative ones, and living this life where you're the maestro of your experience. That to me is exciting. I love that. That's what I think is awesome about hypnosis and NLP. But I'm curious, how would you reconcile that with this view that, well, maybe we just need to get past the idea of thoughts in the first place and changing them and just live as one source, one consciousness? Can they work together? What do you think?
Right. So, you know, this is kind of an interesting thought, because if we get to, you know, one consciousness, we're not going to have creativity anymore. We're not going to have innovation. That's boring.
We
need diversity. And plus, I don't have enough faith that we as a species will ever get there.
Fair enough.
Where NLP and hypnosis are important is to get to that level where you can recognize, okay, this is just a thought. And I don't have to do anything with it. I can just be present and allow it to move in and out of awareness and not attach to it. To be able to do that consistently, you have to dedicate time and effort to it. In fact, you need to be doing things like meditation and breath work, you know, doing inner alchemy.
Yes.
Because it doesn't happen overnight. Most clients who come to see us are not going to have the desire or the time to dedicate to getting to that point when they first come in. They have a problem, they need it solved. NLP and hypnosis do that. NLP and hypnosis then are the bridge into a new world for that client, because now all of a sudden they realize that they're more than what they consciously thought they were. So that sets them down the road of becoming more aware of their inner landscapes, their relationship to their thoughts and their feelings. You know, like I said at the beginning of the call, patterns and techniques create the ritual. They're not necessarily needed, though, to get the change. But for clients, that's an important ritual. They want to know, they want to experience a change in the session and know that when they go back out into the real world, something happened that created change. If, you know, I task all my clients with starting a meditation practice. It's very important for the work I do. The amount of pushback I get from clients who are paying a lot of money to see me, by the way, so you'd think like they'd be totally invested and do the homework.
Yeah.
The amount of pushback to doing a 5-minute practice or a 2-minute practice a day is incredible. Or the amount of times where they'll start and they're really excited, but then they won't continue it. So something like the three principles, to have somebody embody it, they need to have a lot of self-awareness, which a lot of clients just aren't there yet. Hypnosis and NLP, they're the gateway drug to enlightenment.
Yes. That's what I think. That's what I definitely think. Yeah. And I don't know about you, I mean, but it's I imagine that as you practice doing swish patterns on yourself and you do it more and more, then your neurology gets used to it. So you can, negative experience. Well, you know what? I'm just going to plop in a new set of thoughts and change the colors and do all that submodality stuff. And then all of a sudden you can feel good. I mean, do you find yourself doing that on a regular basis? Or did you, at a certain point, were you very conscious of how you were experiencing things to go through the world in a way that just felt better?
I do it very consciously for things like weightlifting. So I every day when I walk through the gym's doors, I do a swish, and I've done it every day for 5 years. And it's just an automatic thing, and it feels good. I like it. In terms of problems, I think we have to be very careful to not gaslight ourselves. You know, there is a balance in going, okay, I have these skills. If I'm feeling bad, I can do things to get myself out of it. Or if I can't, I can go to somebody who can help me get out of it, which is really important. And if we're self-applying NLP principles all the time to things that are unpleasant, sometimes we miss out on the opportunities to learn from those experiences. We don't want to become like robots, unfeeling robots, and we also don't want to have unearned wisdom, meaning, you know, something tragic happens and we just kind of paint over it with a brush and make everything look rosy. What did we get from that then?
Right.
So I think we have to be very careful. And this is about knowing yourself. Like, yeah, there are things that we all do internally to make ourselves feel bad just because, you know, why the hell not? The default mode work. In those instances, then we can go, okay, well, this is my pattern and I'm not going to do this. I'm going to do something different. And then whatever, you know, hypnosis, swish, parts work. Other times, something very real is happening in the world and it's okay to be upset by it. In fact, if I come across, I would be horrified if I came across any NLPer who was like, oh yeah, Ukraine's no big deal. Because, you know, they did some internal process. Like, that's, we got to keep our heart intact. So it's about knowing that balance.
Yeah.
So for me, the biggest takeaway from NLP in terms of daily life are the presuppositions. They are the most powerful part of NLP. And unfortunately, they tend to be glossed over. People think, oh, okay, those are just nice sayings. If you live your life based on the presuppositions, you will live a life of excellence.
Yes. Yes. And we should, that's a good way of getting people to look into NLP. Look into those presuppositions. Type in NLP, go into Google. I mean, it's just a Google search. But yeah, no, that is, they are definitely things I aspire to live by. Wait a minute. You know what? I realized we didn't talk about values. And we didn't really talk about values at all. Maybe we'll have to do another episode. I don't know.
I think we should do another episode. This is fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, the values thing, definitely another rabbit hole I went down. So yeah. Very curious about your thoughts on that and just achievement in society in general and people moving toward. I mean, I did a solo episode recently where I talked about how at the end of the day, I think people in general want to move towards states. When people are talking about moving into the 5D, and this is why hypnosis, again, always is ahead of the curve. It's always there. We were doing it. You know, I love when hypnotists post these articles that say, oh, look, Scientific American just did a piece on the placebo effect, or hypnosis is verified as a... People have been saying it for years. But yeah, even, you know, this idea of moving into the 5D, we all want to have this an experience of our authentic selves, be just experiencing more, experience in general, right? Immersive reality. You see it in New York City. I see it too, where everything's now immersive. People are just more material things were. So are our parents' generation. I grew up where it was like, oh, I'm going to have a nice TV like the kids down the block. But that just so doesn't matter anymore. Let me leave on this note with you. In terms of the move towards an experiential reality, people, I think, unconsciously often moving more towards states of being rather than doings or havings. But I feel like that's where I'm saying hypnosis is ahead of 5D, saying like, yeah, we were all about states, man. We were all about the states. Where do you think hypnosis is valuable for people in this new life, post-pandemic, post-Great Resignation? Do you see it as a collective awakening tool? A lot of questions there. Very curious your thoughts.
So as long as humans have been alive on this planet, we've been looking for ways to alter our states. We've been chasing states since day one. And there's lots of ways of doing it. Hypnosis is one of them. And I think what you find with a lot of the immersive stuff, like especially we see it in New York City.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, people are looking toward technology to be the state changer. And I say unfortunately because technology isn't being used to actually do it in a way that is beneficial. Technology is being used to propel consumerism.
Yes.
Yes. You, like walking down the street, people with their phone up to their face, not paying attention to the actual immersive reality that is life. And who benefits? You know, big companies benefit. Apple benefits. Facebook benefits.
Yes.
You know, technology has given us a promise of a state change, but it's done it in a really evil way. In fact, you know, Facebook had to admit that they knew that social media and the way that they were using their platform was triggering dopamine release. And they designed it to enhance that. And this is really important. A lot of people say dopamine is a reward chemical. It's not. It's a seeking chemical. It causes us to want more. We don't actually get fulfilled by it. This is why you scroll endlessly.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are looking for that way to alter their state, but most people are going about it in a way that might not be always in a mode of goodness for them. So this is where hypnosis comes in. Hypnosis, you know, hypnosis is a wonderful skill to have to be able to go into trance. Meditation is the same. You know, right now we're also in the midst of the psychedelic revolution or renaissance, excuse me.
Yes.
Another way. Disclaimer, not that I'm saying anybody should do that.
Right.
So there are these other modalities that are far more ancient and are offering to connect us to our authenticity. Things that are external, that are firing off the seeking circuits in the brain, are not going to move us towards an authentic mode of being. Things that invite us to go inward and to connect in real life with other people and to share that sacred space, that moves us more towards a state of authenticity. And hypnosis can certainly do that.
Yes. Wow. That is the statement of statements. I love it. Yeah, definitely opened my mind to many different possibilities tonight, which is what hypnotists do. You took me there. I'm so grateful. Jess Marion, we will link to all the websites, as well as, hey, you put Jess Marion's name into Amazon, you will get some fantastically very engaging material. I mean, it's interesting content. It's well-written content. So highly recommend it. Hey, thanks so much for coming on. I am very grateful.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun. I love talking this stuff with like-minded people. So this was awesome. I know it took us a while to finally coordinate calendars, mainly me, to get my stuff sorted.
It's all good. I'm glad.
This was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Of course. Anytime. Jess Marion, thank you so much for coming on. Yes, she took, I don't know, 3 weeks to get back to me, and then we recorded this episode, and it took me 2+ years. The amount of time it takes for you to start feeling that your infant is a little less cute than they used to be. Jess, I hope the wait was worth it. I want to thank Ronnie McGilvery for the theme music. I want to thank Zero Boy for the pre-theme music. If you enjoyed this podcast, go to ratethispodcast.com/openloops. We'd love to hear your unique, weird, mind-bendy words. I love ya. Thanks for listening.